podcast for my mother. She read to me when I was little, so now I'm returning the favour and you're welcome to listen along. It's Thursday and that means I'm reading something offbeat. Sundays are for classics, but whatever I'm reading, it's always great writing. Don't be misled by the title of tonight's podcast. I am not reading blockbuster bestseller Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. Although, snobs be damned, it is a fantastic fun read. No, tonight I am reading the man himself, Leonardo di Ser Piero da Vinci. High Renaissance genius, painter, sculptor, engineer and inventor of the Florentine Republic. Born 1452, because he was also a great writer. And tonight I am reading his short treatise, How to Compose a Battle. He cracked the code. If you follow his approach, you will compose an incredibly compelling painting of a battle scene. But you don't need to be a painter to truly appreciate Leonardo's words. The only deliberate book by Leonardo is a posthumous work, A Treatise on Painting, comprised of 365 brief, perfectly worded notes or chapters from the great artist's notebooks made between 1482 and 1499 in Milano, when Leonardo was working for Ludovico Sforza, the Duke of Milan. The notes were compiled and published in France in 1632. It is a wonderful collection of art rules, the code of art, if you will, from a true genius. The chapters cover everything from the shape of the human form carrying a heavy load to linear perspective to landscapes and, yes, even battle scenes. Before I get to reading, a bit about Leonardo, but really it's difficult to pull out details here and there because his life was fascinating. He led an amazing life for his 67 years. He was a Florentine, born on the wrong side of the bedsheets. Childhood, we simply do not know a lot about it. Papa was a well-to-do notary in Florence who liked to dip his wick, if you know what I mean, and I think you do. Leonardo had 12 half-siblings from Papa, all of them younger and none of whom really interested him at all. He seemed to like Mama, but she married an angry man a year after Leonardo was born, and young Leonardo spent his childhood with Papa's family, grandfather and uncle mostly. By 14, though, he was away from the family, living and working in the studio of super famous Florentine painter at that time, Andrea del Verrocchio. And the only way was up from there, because from Verrocchio, Leonardo got to know Donatello, then Botticelli, Perugino. These are all super greats of Renaissance art, and there were more. Ghiberti, Masaccio, Piero della Francesca. His incredible art was firstly in Florence, then Milano, then Florence again, then Milano again, and then Rome, and lastly France, where he passed away in a chateau in the Loire, probably of a big old stroke. His contribution to art, to the planet's understanding of art, cannot be underestimated. Think about just the main work that you know, the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, all those studies of anatomy and animals, in particular the horse. Salvator Mundi, the world's most expensive painting ever, attributed to Leonardo. And of course, there is Vitruvian Man, the world's best known drawing. You know the one, a square and a circle, perfectly aligned, and in them a standing naked man with arms outstretched side to side, legs together, and the same man also shown with arms raised and outstretched and legs apart. Vitruvian Man was generated by Leonardo in 1490 from an idea explored with his pal Giacomo Andrea. They were interested in the ideas of perfect ratios of form explored by Vitruvius, an architect of ancient Rome, in his book De Architectura. I think Vitruvian Man is another example of Leonardo cracking the code of perfect form. The drawing escaped any publication, by the way, all the way from 1490 to 1810. But as soon as it was published, well, everyone who has seen it has understood it as a work of elegant genius. And it really does seem that everyone has seen it. So, moving on to tonight's read, How to Compose a Battle. Did Leonardo da Vinci paint a famous battle scene? Yes, but we can't find it. We have many drawings and studies for a piece he planned as a monumental mural called the Battle of Anghiari in 1505, about a battle involving four horsemen trying to capture a standard or flag. It was planned for Florence, but where is it? The wall has not been found yet. I still have my fingers and toes crossed that it will be found. It would be wonderful to think something like that could still be around. Some people believe that Giorgio Vasari painted over it, possibly to save it. Who knows? We do know where Vasari's paintings are. And do check out Season 2, Episode 3 of this podcast when I covered Giorgio Vasari's Life of Leonardo. It'll give you more perspective. But I digress. We have many studies of Leonardo's Battle of Anghiari. Peter Paul Rubens made a wonderful study. But I say that Leonardo's words are sufficient to let us see, albeit in our imagination, how truly awesome a battle scene could be. So, to chapter 158 of Leonardo da Vinci's A Treatise on Painting, How to Compose a Battle. And remember, this is written before his Battle of Anghiari painting. So Leonardo was already thinking about all this before he ever mixed a pot of paint for that famous lost battle scene. Let's begin. First, let the air exhibit a confused mixture of smoke arising from the discharge of artillery and musketry, and the dust raised by the horses of the combatants. And observe that dust, being of an earthy nature, is heavy, but yet, by reason of its minute particles, it is easily impelled upwards and mixes with the air. Nevertheless, it naturally falls downwards again, the most subtle parts of it alone gaining any considerable degree of elevation, and at its utmost height it is so thin and transparent as to appear nearly of the colour of the air. The smoke, thus mixing with the dusty air, forms a kind of dark cloud, at the top of which it is distinguished from the dust by a bluish cast, the dust retaining more of its natural colour. On that part from which the light proceeds, this mixture of air, smoke, and dust will appear much brighter than on the opposite side. The more the combatants are involved in this turbulent mist, the less distinctly they will be seen, and the more confused will they be in their lights and shades. Let the faces of the musketeers, their bodies, and every object near them be tinged with a reddish hue, even the air or cloud of dust, in short, all that surrounds them. This red tinge you will diminish in proportion to their distance from the primary cause. The groups of figures which appear at a distance between the spectator and the light will form a dark mass upon a light ground, and their legs will be more undetermined and lost as they approach nearer to the ground, because there the dust is heavier and thicker. If you mean to represent some straggling horses, running out of the main body, introduce also some small clouds of dust, as far distant from each other as the leap of the horse, and these little clouds will become fainter, more scanty and diffused in proportion to their distance from the horse. That nearest to his feet will consequently be the most determined, smallest, and the thickest of all. Let the air be full of arrows in all directions, some ascending, some falling down, and some darting straight forwards. The bullets of the musketry, though not seen, will be marked in their course by a train of smoke, which breaks through the general confusion. The figures in the foreground should have their hair covered with dust, as also their eyebrows, and all parts liable to receive it. The victorious party will be running forwards, their hair and other light parts flying in the wind, their eyebrows lowered, and the motion of every member properly contrasted. For instance, in moving the right foot forwards, the left arm must be brought forwards also. If you make any of them fallen down, mark the trace of his fall on the slippery gore-stained dust. And where the ground is less impregnated with blood, let the print of men's feet and of horses that have passed that way be marked. Let there be some horses dragging the bodies of their riders and leaving behind them a furrow made by the body thus trailed along. The countenances of the vanquished will appear pale and dejected, their eyebrows raised, and much wrinkled about the forehead and cheeks. The tip of their noses somewhat divided from the nostrils by arched wrinkles terminating at the corner of the eyes, those wrinkles being occasioned by the opening and raising of the nostrils. The upper lips turned up, discovering the teeth. Their mouths wide open and expressive of violent lamentation. One may be seen fallen, wounded on the ground, endeavouring with one hand to support his body, and covering his eyes with the other, the palm of which is turned towards the enemy. Others running away, and with open mouths seeming to cry aloud. Between the legs of the combatants let the ground be strewn with all sorts of arms, as broken shields, spears, swords, and the like. Many dead bodies should be introduced, some entirely covered with dust, others in part only. Let the blood, which seems to issue immediately from the wound, appear of its natural colour, and running in a winding course till, mixing with the dust, it forms a reddish kind of mud. Some should be in the agonies of death, their teeth shut, their eyes wildly staring, their fists clenched and their legs in a distorted position. Some may appear disarmed and beaten down by the enemy, still fighting with their fists and teeth, and endeavouring to take a passionate, though unavailing, revenge. There may also be a straggling horse without a rider, running in wild disorder, his mane flying in the wind, beating down with his feet all before him, and doing a deal of damage. A wounded soldier may also be seen falling to the ground and attempting to cover himself with his shield, while an enemy bending over him endeavours to give him the finishing stroke. Several dead bodies should be heaped together under a dead horse. Some of the conquerors, as having ceased fighting, may be wiping their faces from the dirt, collected on them by the mixture of dust with the water from their eyes. The reserve corps will be seen advancing gaily, but cautiously, their eyebrows directed forwards, shading their eyes with their hands to observe the motions of the enemy amidst clouds of dust and smoke, and seeming attentive to the orders of their chief. You may also make their commander, holding up his staff, pushing forwards and pointing towards the place where they are wanted. A river may likewise be introduced, with horses fording it, dashing the water about between their legs and in the air, covering all the adjacent ground with water and foam. Not a spot is to be left without some marks of blood and carnage. And that's where we'll leave it tonight. I find that quite the description, and I hope you agree. I don't have the gift of art, but honestly, Leonardo's words are so concise and rational, I almost feel I could come up with something approximating a battle scene. Leonardo really cracked the code on art instructions. I expect every art student gives the treatise a read, because it is so wonderful and from such a genius. But even those of us who aren't artistically inclined can appreciate the effort that he went to share this information. How about you? Are you feeling artistically inspired by Leonardo da Vinci's words? I hope so. It is one thing to be a gifted artist. It's quite another to share the gift and quite another again to share it in a way that everyone can understand. Leonardo, if he were alive today, would have a very popular YouTube channel and Patreon account, I think. He plainly had no problem actually detailing what it takes to make art to a wide audience. Yes, he had his strange backwards code writing with a mirror, but that was more a code to avoid industrial espionage. The treatise, on the other hand, shows the man from Vinci was a generous man with his skills and a great writer, even if writing isn't one of the skills that's commonly listed about him. I just adore Leonardo da Vinci. What a treasure he was and is. Right, that's your lot. I'll be back on Sunday, 9 p.m. Sydney time, with a classic, and I wish you all a great and safe week wherever you are. This little podcast has seen quite the jump in listeners over the past couple months, and I am so here for it. It is incredibly motivating, and I want to thank particularly listeners Shauna and Greg in the US and Robert in France for reaching out with suggestions for reading. Goethe and Molière. Very nice. Do please keep sharing the podcast with friends and family who love great writing and the joys of reading aloud. And maybe share it with a student, someone who's studying great literature. They may find it helpful and diverting too. Till next time then, take care. It really is slippery out there. And thanks for listening to Nettie Reads.